It is Friday, January the 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, might Mexico City be paying for a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico?
It's pure folly to think that the Mexican government, either directly or indirectly, is going to cut the United States a check to pay for the border wall. In fact, it would be political suicide for any Mexican politician to even entertain that idea.
Also ahead, President Trump believing there could have been voter fraud in the November election, getting a new WHO leader, plus a look at brain games. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump has signed executive actions that direct the construction of a U.S.-Mexico border wall and threatens a cut in billions of federal funds to sanctuary cities that harbor illegal immigrants. Less than a week into his presidency, Mr. Trump said a nation without borders is no nation.
We're in the middle of a crisis on our southern border. The unprecedented surge of illegal migrants from Central America is harming both Mexico and the United States, and I believe the steps we will take, starting right now, will improve the safety in both of our countries. Beginning today, the United States of America gets back control of its borders, gets back its borders. The Secretary of Homeland Security, working with myself and my staff, will begin immediate construction of a border wall. This will also help Mexico by deterring illegal immigration from Central America and by disrupting violent cartel networks.
Meantime, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto has canceled next week's meeting with Mr. Trump in Washington after the president said the talks should be called off if Mexico keeps insisting it will not pay for the wall. Latin American scholar Mark Jones of Rice University tells my colleague Victor Beatty the cost of the wall could be from $10 billion to $20 billion.
For that to occur, we need legislation passed by Congress. And that's going to be a very difficult hill for President Trump to climb, because while a majority of Republicans, pretty much all Republicans, are in favor of having a more secure border, they're less willing to spend that type of money for the relatively limited returns and security that it would provide.
He says Mexico's going to pay for it.
It's pure folly to think that the Mexican government, either directly or indirectly, is going to cut the United States a check to pay for the border wall. In fact, there would be political suicide for any Mexican politician to even entertain that idea. Now, it might be possible for the United States to pass legislation that tax remittances sent from people in the United States to Mexico, but that would be a drop in the bucket in terms of the overall cost of the wall. It would be tricky because it's something that Republicans often oppose, that is raising taxes, and certainly you're not going to get many Democratic votes for. But it is important to keep in mind that you can build the most secure wall on the border that doesn't allow anyone to actually cross who isn't crossing legally. That would only affect about half of the amount of undocumented immigrants, because close to half of undocumented immigrants arrive to the United States legally, either by air, sea, or land, and simply overstay their visa or other legal device. So even if you build the most secure wall, that's only affecting half of the undocumented immigration problem in the United States.
Mark Jones, a Latin American scholar at Rice University, speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And later in the program, the social media reaction to that border wall. In addition to immigration and a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico, President Trump continues to be concerned about possible voter fraud during the election that he won in November. Mr. Trump won the state-by-state electoral college voting needed to secure the presidency, but lost the popular vote to Democrat Hillary Clinton by nearly 3 million ballots in the November 8th election. But Mr. Trump has blamed that margin on millions of illegal voters casting ballots for Clinton. President Trump announced a major investigation into the voter fraud on Twitter and reiterated his beliefs in an interview with ABC News.
I said it, and I said it strongly, because what's going on with voter fraud is horrible. That's number one. Number two, I would have won the popular vote if I was campaigning for the popular vote. I would have gone to California, where I didn't go at all. I would have gone to New York, where I didn't campaign at all. I would have gone to a couple of places that I didn't go to. And I would have won that much easier than winning the Electoral College. But as you know, the Electoral College is all that matters. It doesn't make any difference. With that being said, if you look at voter registration, you look at the dead people that are registered to vote, who vote, you look at people that are registered in two states, you look at all of these different things that are happening with registration, you take a look at those registration, you're going to find, and we're going to do an investigation on it.
But 3 to 5 million illegal votes.
Well, we're going to find out, but it could very well be that.
My colleague Lori London asked attorney Jerry Goldfeder, an election law and voting rights expert, if there could be any substance to Mr. Trump's voter fraud claims.
Either he's heard about something or he's been told to read an old report or something like that, but there's absolutely no proof that there has been any fraud, let alone in the millions.
How likely would it or could it be that this happened?
It's next to impossible. Those numbers are astronomical. Every now and again, you have one or two people who vote who are not supposed to vote, and it's usually inadvertent. It's not even intentional. But to talk about millions, even to talk about dozens, is really beyond the pale.
He mentioned that people who are deceased are voting, people that are possibly voting in multiple states. Is this possible?
To be fair, I think he's not saying that. There are people who are deceased who remain on the voting rolls. There are people who are registered in more than one state. But that doesn't necessarily mean that either one of these categories constitute voting fraud. It means the registration lists are not up to date or not accurate. But that's different than people who are dead voting or people voting in more than one place. There's no proof of that. There is demonstrably proof that voting rolls contain people who've since died, or if they've moved, they're in more than one place. If a person is registered in more than one state, as long as they're only voting in one state, then that's perfectly appropriate, and the place from which they move needs to clean up their rolls.
What would an investigation into something like this that he's ordering involve, and how costly would it be? And didn't we already have an investigation into voter fraud after Green Party candidate Jill Stein asked for recounts?
As a matter of fact, the now president's legal team arguing against Jill Stein's case, which was in and of itself pretty frivolous, the Trump legal team said there was no fraud. So I think at least those states that Stein raised the issue, there was really no proof of any fraudulent activity. And to conduct an investigation as to the kinds of numbers that the president is referring to would require the attorneys general or the secretaries of state in every state in the union to do an investigation at all of their polling sites. And I don't exactly know what they would be looking for, because nobody's suggested that they know of any voting fraud.
He did also suggest that all of these so-called illegal votes were for Hillary Clinton. How would he have that information?
He has no idea. He just said it, it appears. There's no proof that there have been millions of fraudulent votes. There's no proof that there's been thousands or hundreds or dozens or any fraudulent votes. I don't know how he could claim that. I think he is setting up a straw man that's taking a lot of attention, but doesn't have any basis in reality.
Is it possible that an investigation would turn up less votes for him?
I don't think so.
Overall, do we or have we ever had a voter fraud problem in this country?
Yeah, from time to time, there has been some fraud. Very, very few cases. In the 19th century, before we had our modern electoral systems, there was more of that. But there hasn't really been any more than a handful of improper voting in the last generation.
So overall, what, as an expert in this field, what is your observation from this whole issue here?
Well, I think even though there's really no proof that there's been any fraudulent voting in the 2016 election, if there were to be an investigation in all 50 states, and if it were done honestly in a bipartisan way, I think that there would be a conclusion that there was no fraud. which I think would give everyone a lot of comfort that our system, at least in this respect, worked. And perhaps we can roll back some of the draconian laws that make it very, very difficult for people to register and vote.
It sounds like, though, that the opposite might happen as far as stricter voting laws under this president.
Not if they're based on facts. If in fact he's making a claim that there's fraudulent voting and there's an investigation and the investigation turns up no fraudulent voting or very, very minimal fraudulent voting, there's no basis for stricter voting laws. In fact, there's a real basis and rationale for more liberal voting laws, making it easier for people to vote rather than in the direction that some of the states have gone.
Election law and voting rights expert, attorney Jerry Goldfeder. He was speaking with International Edition's Lori London. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Three contenders for the World Health Organization's top job have entered the final lap in a year-long campaign to win that coveted post. We get the story now from Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
In a series of marathon back-to-back press conferences, the three candidates have presented their qualifications and their ideas for making the World Health Organization a better and more effective institution. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, a former health minister and foreign minister from Ethiopia, is the first African candidate to head the WHO. He unabashedly tells journalists that he is the best candidate for the job because he has both national and international experience.
At the national level, I helped or led the design of a reform of the health system of Ethiopia. Not only that, I implemented the reform and also got result. At international level, as you know, I chaired almost all major institutions, global health institutions, Global Fund, Rollback Malaria Board, UNAIDS Board, and also the Partnership for Maternal, Neonatal and Child Health.
Tedros seems to have a slight edge over the other two finalists. WHO's executive board, which selected the three finalists from a group of five, gave Tedros 30 votes compared to 28 for the Pakistani contender Sania Nishtar and 18 votes for David Nabarro from Britain. Despite his low polling, Nabarro, who has worked for WHO for 5.5 years and has been prominent in the global fight against Ebola, avian influenza, and other emergencies, is confident he is the best person for the job.
Look at my record. Look at it. You will find that I have had an impact inside the system that shows that it is possible to make this system work to get results.
Pakistani cardiologist, author, and activist Sania Nishtar has held important positions both inside and outside government. She says her biggest strength, one which will serve WHO well, is that she knows what she does not know. She says she is fully committed to getting the right answer if she does not know something and getting the job done. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Scientists at the University of Washington in Seattle here in the U.S. are trying to learn if the human brain can work in a virtual environment without stimulation from regular senses like touch or sight. VOA's David Byrd reports that researchers hope the technology can be used to help people with brain injury.
In a computer lab at the University of Washington, research assistant Justin Abernethy is fitted with a transcranial magnetic stimulation device. It looks kind of like a large plastic figure eight-shaped device that is connected to the back of Abernethy's head. The device will send a signal directly to Abernethy's brain and help him play a computer game without getting information from his other senses. Rajesh Rao is a professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Washington.
The fundamental question that we were asking here was, is it possible to send information from artificial sensors or computer-created worlds directly into the brain such that the brain can start to understand that information and make use of it to solve a task?
The TMS coil is non-invasive, but it does stimulate areas of Abernethy's brain to produce a flash of light. The research assistant says that those flashes are his clues to do something different in the game.
I'm trying to get through this maze. So what's going to happen is the TMS is going to present a phosphine to me, which is a brief flash of light represented in my brain. And whenever I see that phosphine, I'll know there's a wall in this maze, and my job is to go down the ladder. Whenever I don't see a phosphine, so I don't see this flash of light, my job is just to go forward in the hall and get out of the maze.
Darby Losey of the University of Washington Institute for Learning and Brain Science says the goal is to see if the technology can help replace lost senses like sight or hearing.
Yeah, so we're essentially trying to give humans a sixth sense, so to speak. They're navigating this maze with information delivered directly to their brain, non-invasively through magnetic stimulation. They're navigating this maze without using their traditional five senses.
Professor Rajesh Rao says the long-term goal of the research is to help people who have brain injuries.
So if you look at virtual reality technologies today, we use goggles, headsets, and displays, but ultimately it's the brain that creates reality for us. And so you can look at, in the future, you know, the possibility that the experience of virtual reality could be much more richer if we can send much richer information into the brain directly. So, for example, the sense of touch, maybe even the sense of smell or taste, which we cannot do today. The kind of approach that we're taking and that we're suggesting here could potentially lead to much richer virtual reality experiences, as well as, you know, lead to new technologies to assist people with sensory deficits, for example, the blind, using non-invasive brain stimulation technologies.
The team is also looking at how direct brain stimulation could enhance visual or other sensory experiences. However, they say it will be 15 to 20 years before a commercial application for their work will be available. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And now it's time to find out what's trending on social media. Here with all of that, G. Abby Lee. Hey, G., what's happening?
Hi, Steve. It looks like President Donald Trump's plan to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border is the biggest topic on Twitter. President Trump sent out two tweets earlier Thursday in which he said, if Mexico is unwilling to pay for the badly needed wall, then it would be better to cancel the upcoming meeting. Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto also responded via Twitter. His handle is @EPN and he tweeted in Spanish, this morning we have informed the White House that I will not attend the meeting scheduled for next Tuesday with a POTUS.
Anything else, G, trending regarding the wall?
The chief of the U.S. Border Patrol, Mark Morgan, has resigned and people are sharing their thoughts on the resignation on Twitter. It's unclear whether he was asked to resign or chose to. Some are speculating that coming from the FBI, he wasn't liked by the Border Patrol union that endorsed Trump. But others are saying people in those roles leaving their jobs is nothing new.
Well, I'm fairly sure, G, as we move along, we'll be hearing a great deal more about that, about Morgan. We've got to shift gears now because I hope you have a second. All this I've been reading out there, I've just got to know what people are saying about this new research that cats are actually smarter than dogs.
Steve, I was so happy to read this because the conventional thought is that cats are not as smart as dogs. But a new study conducted by Japanese scientists say cats and dogs have similar levels of memory. People are tweeting, whoever thought otherwise has never been owned by a cat. I like the wording here because it's very accurate. Others are also joking, they may be as intelligent as dogs, but they just don't care about the opinion of scientists. Steve?
I think that's probably right, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
High up in a remote village, a woman's hands are blackened from hours of squeezing marijuana buds to press out the resin. She's making hashish to sell to people who make the long, hard trek to get it. But the Indian government is cracking down on cannabis products in this area, known as Malana, in Himachal Pradesh. Gauri Masi is 80 years old. Wheat and other grains don't grow on this land. Nothing else grows here. What can we do, she says. Malana village governed itself for hundreds of years. Now police are destroying their marijuana plants with machetes. Maheshwar Singh is a local lawmaker.
The government of India had made a policy. They would be provided some alternate employment, but that we have not been able to touch.
Cannabis might be one of the oldest domesticated crops. And as one village councilman said, we're not going to go hungry. If we have to go to jail, so be it. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us today. Now a little something from our music department.
Uptown got its hustlers. Bowery got its bumps. 42nd Street got Big Jim Walker. He fool shooting son of a gun. Yeah, he big and dumb as a man can come, but he's stronger than a country horse. And when the bad folks all get together at night, you know they all call Big Jim boss just because. You see, you don't tug on Superman's cape, you don't spit into the wind, you don't pull the mask off old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with Jim.
James Joseph Jim Croce, born in 1943 and died in 1973, is among a number of talented artists taken from us all too soon.
Don't tug on Superman's cape. You don't spit into the wind. You don't pull the mask off the old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with Jim.
Jim Croce was an American singer-songwriter who's been described as the voice of America's working class. Between 1966 and 73, Croce released 5 studio albums and 11 singles.
Non-support. Tried to buy me an executive position, but no matter how smooth I talk, he wouldn't listen to the fact that I was a genius. The man says we got all that we can use. Now I got them steadily depressing, low down, mind messing, working at the car wash blues.
Croce sang about what he knew growing up in South Philadelphia, where he was part of a close-knit family that loved music. His friends, Melvin Goldfield and Cheech Marin, appeared on a VH1 exclusive looking back at Croce's life.
Yeah, well, the streets are all part of his blood, I think, you know, and part of mine as well. And it was exciting for us, it's sort of titillating to be out on the streets.
And, you know, we'd close places, we'd stay up till it got light. And I really miss that. I really, really miss that.
Till a day, he should be smoking on a big cigar. But did I get myself straight? I guess I'll just have to wait in my rubber suit, rubber this car.
Jim was the first in his family to graduate from college, attending Villanova University in a Philadelphia suburb. A few years before, Croce met his future wife, Ingrid Jacobson, also an accomplished singer.
I fell madly in love. I couldn't even imagine that life had ever existed before he walked into that room with that guitar.
Cause I got there, steadily depressing, low down, mind messing, working at the car wash too.
Ingrid and Jim took to the road once they married. With no money in their pockets, they did have a huge love for making music. Just after performing to a sold-out crowd in Natchitoches, Louisiana, on September 20, 1973, Jim and six others boarded a chartered twin-engine Beechcraft plane, headed to their next gig in Texas. But they never made it. The plane crashed at the end of the runway into a grove of trees. No one survived. Yeah, hey, listen, if he walked up to me, I would call him sir as well. How about that? One more story for you. The charity behind Red Nose Day says the campaign to end child poverty returning to the U.S. this year. Comic Relief announced Thursday that the 2017 fundraising efforts will culminate with Red Nose Day, a TV special in May. Founded by Britain filmmaker Richard Curtis, Red Nose Day expanded to the U.S. 2 years ago, where it has raised $60 million to date. Funds are raised simply through selling these little noses. They look like red clown noses, and people wear them on that day, and it's a big deal. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Idnuk Koo, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
75 years ago, on January 20, 1942, senior officials of the German Nazi Party met in a villa in the Wannsee district of Berlin to discuss what they called the final solution to the Jewish question, the deportation and extermination of the Jewish population of German-occupied Europe. Subsequently, millions of Jews, along with political opponents and activists, communists, intellectuals, Romani people, gays and lesbians, and mentally handicapped people residing in Germany or German-occupied territories, were arrested and transported to concentration camps. Most of them ended up in extermination camps, built specifically to kill millions of people by execution and extreme work under starvation conditions. In the 3 years between the Wannsee Conference and the end of the Second World War, 6 million Jews, as well as 4 to 5 million non-Jewish prisoners, perished in these death camps. Today, the genocide that was committed by the Nazi regime against the European Jews is known as the Holocaust. The Auschwitz-Birkenau facility in Poland, the largest and deadliest of the extermination camps, was liberated by the Russian army on January 27, 1945. The camp was nearly empty that day, as those prisoners who were still capable of walking were herded by their guards away from the invading armies. The liberators were met by some 7,000 skeletal prisoners who were too weak to be evacuated by their captors, and mountains of dead bodies. The Holocaust was a crime against humanity so horrendous that the community of nations vowed to never forget, lest such atrocity happen again. And that is why, every January 27th, we observe the International Holocaust Remembrance Day. It's been 75 years, nearly three generations since the end of the Second World War, and few are left of those who survived the Holocaust and those who broke open the death camp doors and freed the condemned. It is up to us now to never again allow hatred and intolerance to drown out our humanity and respect for the lives of others.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for, what's